This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In the WNBA's conference championships, the Detroit Shock and the Indiana Fever are playing for the opportunity to represent the East. Either the Phoenix Mercury or the San Antonio Silver Stars will be victorious in the West. After the first round of the WNBA playoffs ended, fans of women's pro basketball had to be wondering whether the conference finals and the league championship series could live up to the preliminaries. Monstrous leads evaporated, overtimes were commonplace, and games were won on last-second shots. Joining me now to recap that action and look ahead as well is Clay Callum, who writes for the website Full Court Press. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks so much, Bill.
The first round series between the Connecticut Sun and the Indiana Fever was characterized by leads blown and overtimes endured. How much of the credit for the Fever's success goes to the apparently and very suddenly healthy Tamika Catchings?
Well, an enormous amount. Not only does Catchings score and rebound, she averaged 15 rebounds a game in the three games. She makes big plays. She's a great defender. She makes her teammates better. If Lauren Jackson weren't around, she would be considered the best player in the world. On the other hand, of course, Detroit got back Cheryl Ford, who wasn't supposed to play. So things will balance out here as they move on.
Well, as you say, that other first-round series involving Eastern teams saw the New York Liberty crush the Detroit Shock in Game 1, 73-51. Too bad the Liberty couldn't have borrowed just a few of those extra points for Game 2 or Game 3.
You always tend to feel that way. The Liberty really, I think, caught Detroit by surprise in Game 1 and really in Games 2 and 3. Talent-wise, Detroit is far superior to the Liberty, taking nothing away from New York. But Pat Coyle did a tremendous job with that team, and they battled the defending champs right down to the wire in a free throw here or a layup there. And who knows? Detroit goes out in the first round.
Sacramento and San Antonio traded blowouts in their first-round series, and then somebody sent those teams the script, and they finally played a close game. Were you surprised by the outcome there?
Not really. In my preview, I said this series is too close to call, and it'll probably come down to a big play. And that's exactly what happened, and Becky Hammon made the big play. But a lot of credit has to go to Vicky Johnson. Those who didn't see the game on TV, I think it was on NBA TV, unfortunately, as were many of these games, they weren't able to get on ESPN. But Vicky Johnson, a veteran player who played with the Liberty for many years, handed the ball off to Hammond, and then instead of just watching Becky go to work, went around, found a spot under the basket, and when Becky was really triple-teamed, she dished the ball to Vicky Johnson, the veteran, in the right spot at the right time, and San Antonio moves on.
Phoenix was the only team to get through round one in just two games, so I guess that made it inevitable that the Mercury's first game in the conference finals would not only be close but controversial.
Oh, very controversial. Very controversial. The world of women's basketball is abuzz today and has been since Thursday night with the way the game ended. Phoenix up six with 19 seconds to go. Diana Taurasi fouls a three-point shooter, which any coach will tell you is just a cardinal sin, especially since the Phoenix coach, Paul Westhead, had just said, don't foul. Taurasi turns the ball over with no one really putting any pressure on her. Becky Hammon makes a three because Tangela Smith doesn't step out on her, as she should have. Then Phoenix inbounds the ball 80 feet from the basket, and Shanna Crosley, for no apparent reason, decides she needs to step up on Cappy Pondexter. The whistle blows, and Cappy shoots the free throws that win the game. Just an incredible sequence of events.
And the WNBA looking a little like the NBA, with at least half the people in attendance shouting that there was no foul there at all.
And speaking of the people in attendance, there were 14,000 in San Antonio for that game. That's a tremendous statement for the WNBA. The thing is, Cappy Pondexter had fallen down, and Lisa Mattingly, one of the best officials in the women's game, had to blow the whistle. At that point, if you're a player, you never want to give the official the chance to make the call against you. And when Crosley stepped up toward Pondexter, 80 feet from the basket with 2 seconds to go, she gave Mattingly the opportunity to blow the whistle. If she steps back, they may still be playing.
The Indiana Fever shocked the Detroit Shock. Boy, I love saying things like that last night. But does Detroit's postseason experience give them the advantage in that series anyway?
Not anymore. Not anymore. Indiana is playing well. They survived that knockdown, drag-out series with Connecticut. Detroit's confidence has really been shaken. The Shock lost their last four regular season games, were pushed by the 16-18 New York Liberty in the first round of the playoffs. I think this is Indiana's series.
It's probably not fair to expect more overtime games and last-second shots throughout the remainder of the playoffs, Clay, but I suppose it is fair to ask for your predictions regarding the finalists and the eventual winner. What do you think?
Indiana moves on. Phoenix moves on. I think Phoenix gets it done. I think Phoenix just scores too much for Indiana. Don't think that they can stop them.
Clay Callum writes for the website Full Court Press, and he joins me from time to time throughout the summer game as played by the WNBA. Thanks, Clay.
All righty, Bill. Good talking to you.
David Beckham's arrival in America has not been the only summer story involving a talented, charismatic MLS import. The Chicago Fire added Cuauhtemoc Blanco this season. The Mexican superstar won numerous championships and MVP honors playing for his Mexican club team. He also played for the Mexican national team in two World Cups and in the 1996 Olympic Games. Beckham and Blanco have much in common. They're standout players in their 30s who just happen to be fodder for the tabloids. But even before Beckham's injury this week, Blanco had the edge on the field. From Chicago, Yolanda Perdomo reports.
On a balmy Saturday night in the Chicago suburb of Bridgeview, Toyota Park is filling up with people wearing the Fire's red and white. Many have Blanco's number 10. Cuauhtemoc Blanco is already the Fire's most popular player, even though he's been with the team for a little more than a month. Blanco in Chicago is a welcome sight to fans who've watched him for years in Mexico. Jesus Gonzalez is wearing an old yellow jersey from Blanco's Club America team, a team where Blanco was so beloved, they retired his yellow number 10.
Of Cuauhtemoc, what can I say? He's the best. Almost all of the Mexican people come to root for Cuauhtemoc Blanco, for the Fire too, but for me, it's Cuauhtemoc Blanco.
Raul Lopez has been a Chicago Fire fan for some time, and he thinks Blanco's presence will help the team on the field and in the ticket booth.
He always puts a show. No matter whether he's happy, whether he's frustrated, angry, it doesn't matter. All the hype that's been going on with Beckham, I mean, he's basically like the Hispanic version of Beckham for Chicago Fire fans. What's been going on in L.A. with Beckham, you know, same thing's been going on here with Cuauhtemoc.
Fire goal scored in the 44th minute of the play by number 10, Cuauhtemoc Blanco! The goal, unassisted.
Cuauhtemoc was the name of a 16th century Aztec ruler. In honor of his namesake, the 34-year-old Blanco celebrates his goals by getting on bended knee, taking a warrior stance with both arms pointing toward the sky. He's also known as the White Shark. Some say he is a warrior, a ball of energy who scores but can cause friction. In Mexico, Blanco fought with opposing players, ex-coaches, referees, and even members of the media. In Chicago, he's humble and soft-spoken, even a little shy. The Shark is testing new waters, figuring out a new team, a new country, and a new language.
There are lots of Latinos on the team, and they help me communicate with the other players. But I'm going to learn English soon. Every country has a different style of play, but you have to adapt. Adapt to what the coaches want, and work together with your teammates, which is really important.
Blanco is a good fit with the team's Mexican fan base, and according to the Fire, attendance has significantly increased since his arrival. Blanco says he hopes he's a source of pride for his countrymen and women, the way they are for him.
I hope to make them proud. I'm happy to give people autographs or take a picture with them. For me, it's an honor to make them happy. From the games that I've played here, I've seen lots of Mexicans, and to tell you the truth, I'm really proud of them. Many of them come from Mexico and leave their families behind to work. And that takes courage. They come looking for work, not to rob anyone, simply to work and make a better life for themselves.
Importante, ¿no? Porque es gente que quiere salir adelante.
Work is just what Blanco has done since arriving, tallying 2 goals and 4 assists in just 5 games. Unlike Beckham, his impact has been immediate. Blanco is constantly asked about the comparisons to Beckham and admits it's tiresome.
Siempre me preguntan lo mismo, entonces,
yes, they always ask me about that. And I always say you can't compare one player to another. Ronaldinho and Ronaldo are different, and I don't think there should be any comparison here.
Luis Arroyave covers soccer for the Chicago Tribune. He says there's another reason the two superstars are linked.
They're both being counted on to bring this new, or not new, but this U.S. league up to the forefront. And, you know, they're going to be compared, and we'll see who has a better season. So far, it's been Blanco. And, you know, he has that impact that Beckham doesn't have. It's lucky for the Fire because he's delivered on what he's expected to do.
Blanco says it'll take time for the MLS to bring in other international players and expand the league's popularity.
El fútbol es muy bonito. A la gente americana le va a encantar.
It's a beautiful sport, and I think more Americans will love it. I think the future is bright because the MLS is putting together some important contracts, and they're going to bring in important players to the MLS. I hope people come out and support us. Not me, but the whole team. Support us during good times and bad. For us, it's really important. And for us to play a good game for the fans, it's a great feeling.
Chicago Fire fans hope their shark will continue to tear up opponents with goals and assists and help them secure a spot in the playoffs, which begin in October. For Only a Game, I'm Yolanda Perdomo in Chicago.
Chicago Fire! Chicago Fire!
As our listeners know, I'm not the most tech-savvy guy, and I'm still struggling with the definition of the podcast, so I'll once again consult the dictionary. Pod, a somewhat elongated two-valved seed vessel, as that of a pea or bean, cast, to throw or set aside, discard or reject. So, if you'd like to discard peas or reject beans, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, majoring in drum majoring. But first, every year at this time, some number of small-time college football teams pack their equipment in their buses and head to places like Ann Arbor, South Bend, or Gainesville for an opening week pummeling by the big-time schools and for the big-time paycheck the small-time athletic programs need. On Thursday, college football's opening night provided few surprises. Number 2 LSU won 45-0. Number 16 Rutgers, which in years past was usually the routee, routed Buffalo 38-3. And 10th-ranked Louisville squeaked by Murray State 73-10. But the early season schedule may not be entirely lopsided. Joining me to discuss that and provide a preview for the rest of the season is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, please tell me you didn't take Murray State in the points.
Murray and 64.
That would have done it.
USC has given up 48 in some places in Vegas this weekend to Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
So not only is there the political scandal in Idaho, but they are likely to get pummeled by USC. So bad week all around.
Well, there is no dearth of early season blowouts, but there are some potentially good matchups between ranked teams during the first 2 weeks. Didn't these bigger schools get the memo? Don't they know they're supposed to schedule games with patsies like Temple, Albertus Magnus, and the Ali Akbar College of Music?
Yes, I think Electoral College gets fit in there, too. give you an extra one. Really, there's not many. Television and a little bit of competitive fire still drives a couple of these games. Unfortunately, it's probably the worst trend in college football is everybody ducks all the good teams. The biggest problem is, Saturday, Michigan will play Appalachian State, and 110,000 people will actually pay to watch Michigan beat Appalachian State. No, by 40 or 50 points.
Yeah, I was going to say, no need to throw out the record book when these two traditional powerhouses
that
meet.
That USC-Idaho game, it will be a sellout. So, the fans can only blame themselves because as long as they keep going to these not even games, This would be like watching the Yankees play a single-A baseball team. As long as you're going, you're willing to do that, they're going to keep playing it because they make a lot of money.
At the top of everybody's top 25 rankings is the University of Southern California. The Trojans fell short of the national championship game last year, but everybody's so confident that USC will be in that BCS championship game this year that they will almost certainly lose by 20 to Washington in 4 weeks, right?
It's a long season. It's hard to go undefeated, even when you have the incredible talent that USC has. And they have probably a good 20 to 30 players on their roster that will play in the NFL someday, maybe even more considering some of the freshmen and things like that. So they're gonna line up what is essentially a future pro team. They just lost one guy, but for a while there they had 10 high school All-American running backs.
Oh, my God.
One left, and he went to Florida.
Yeah.
Usually when you transfer, you have to transfer down to a worse school. He transferred to the defending national champions. He couldn't get on the field at USC. But, you know, kids are young. There's emotion. There's road games. There's a reason that a lot of years no one goes undefeated or only one team does it. But if there is ever a team to do it, it's Southern Cal. Their talent level is vastly superior to anyone else in the country.
Defending BCS champion Florida is back, but with a questionable defense, as I understand it. Can the football Gators match the accomplishments of the basketball Gators and win back-to-back titles?
Probably not. The one thing about where Florida plays, the Southeastern Conference, it is the most difficult conference. It's the best conference in college football, and you have to run a gauntlet of five or six very difficult games to go undefeated or even have just one loss. They lost a game last year. And to do that, you really have to have be firing on all cylinders to even get out of there with one loss. Some of these other leagues, like the Big Ten, the Big 12, the Pac-10, you have a lot of breathers. You might only have one or two really tough games during the season. So I don't think Florida is going to repeat national championship. You can't go and win the SEC with a lot of question marks. It's just too tough of a road for them.
Last year, Boise State wrapped up an undefeated season with a thrilling Fiesta Bowl upset over Oklahoma, yet this year, Boise State barely made the preseason top 25. What do they have to do, rip up the team's infamous blue turf before the voters take the Broncos seriously?
The Smurf turf in Boise, Idaho, will never leave. You know, I think part of it is just, I've never understood poll voters, but there's an element of just familiarity. And I don't know why they're not ranked higher. They did lose their quarterback. They lost some great players, but they have their great running back returning, and they have a chance to go undefeated again. Their big competition is Hawaii. Hang loose. The Rainbows are a great team this year, and they're the ones that are trying to become the next Boise State, if you will. Those two teams are the two best teams that are going to, come out of a lesser league, if you will.
All right, it's time to predict who will be in the BCS championship game in New Orleans. We may or may not bring this up again when you are proven wrong in January.
Uh-oh. Well, I'm going to take the chalk pick of USC. They're too good. They will be one, and my other is going to be the University of West Virginia, which has a tremendous offense and has probably the easiest road to being undefeated, which is really the key to the BCS. It's as important who you play and who you're able to sneak by than actually you got to win all the games, but it's just easier. They have the best schedule. They have their toughest games at home, and they don't have that many tough ones. So I think West Virginia and USC will end the season both undefeated, and they will meet up at the Sugar Bowl, and USC will crush them.
Okay. John, make sure we put that little piece of tape away for future reference. Dan Wetzel covers college football for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you. Take care.
For 30 years, University of Massachusetts Minuteman Marching Band Director George N. Parks has spent his summers teaching high school musicians the leadership skills essential to being a drum major. His Drum Major Academy, or DMA, is now held at many locations around the country, but the one held each year on Parks' home turf in Amherst, Massachusetts, is considered Drum Major Mecca. Amy Mayer visited the Super DMA this summer. She has this report.
Ask the high school participants, the college students who volunteer, the staff, and the parents who send their kids here what sets the Drum Major Academy apart, and you get one resounding answer.
Mr. Parks, George Parks.
George M. Parks.
George Parks.
George Parks and his reputation.
Well, welcome to DMA 2007. Well, that's pretty meager.
Hundreds of teenagers sit on the pavement in front of the UMass Fine Arts Center wearing T-shirts, shorts, and flip-flops. Some are enrolled in the Color Guard, mobile percussion, and regular marching band programs, but the majority are here as drum majors. George Parks wanders through the throngs of students wearing a headset microphone.
How many want to be drum majors so you can find that little freshman, the one that's struggling, the one that doesn't know if he wants to stay in band, and you can help give that person a great experience? Okay? You're all lying, by the way. You want to be drum major because they announce your name. They say, drum major, is your band ready? And you think, oh, my band.
The flip-flops are gone by morning. Students wear sturdier shoes to march on the asphalt parking lot. Here, they hone their ability to listen to commands and respond with precision. Every day includes an individual march-off in which all the students begin marching together. As kids misstep, they are eliminated until just one person remains standing. But the spirit of cooperation and group learning tempers the competitive drive. The program encourages students to support each other. Melanie Frith will be a senior drum major at West Hill High School in Stamford, Connecticut this fall.
George Parks talked to us in the beginning, and he had a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of jokes, and, you know, first when you get here, you might be nervous. What's this going to be like? Are they going to, you know, be mean to me? But he was really enthusiastic, and it was really helpful to get you into it the first night.
Band members, flag twirlers, and drum majors alike all say their training with Parks enhances their high school marching experience and their lives. Heidi Sarver, now the director of the University of Delaware Blue Hen Marching Band, works summers with the DMA. As a student, she transferred from Penn State to work with Parks and became a UMass drum major. She says Parks' personality sets the tone.
We do 10, 11 other workshops around the country where he's there for the beginning, or so for about the halfway point, and then leaves. And certainly the dynamic does change when he's gone. The philosophies are intact. The teaching methods are intact.
Sarver says marching band is the vehicle for teaching life skills, such as fostering good group dynamics and recovering from mistakes. In the parking lot, each student practices leading a squad of six through a marching routine. Every day, a competition identifies the best squad. As groups are eliminated, they whoop and cheer from the sidelines for the others. College marchers help students evaluate their progress and decide what to work on. Volunteer Kate Bertelli, a UMass drum major, says the meticulous instruction sets the DMA apart from other summer programs.
First off, this is an academy. It's not band camp.
Rather, she says, it's a focused training for band leaders. Here they learn how to teach and motivate their own bands. Bertelli first attended years ago as a high school student, then enrolled at UMass. She returns every summer.
I keep coming back mainly because Mr. Parks is just phenomenal. It's one of those privileges to work with Mr. Parks. He's one of those guys that, you know, like a figurehead, Queen Elizabeth kind of thing, but he's a real person that you can actually go and talk to. And, for example, like right now, he's giving a starred thought, and just his insight on so many things really makes me think.
So here we go, starred thought. You never get a second chance at a first impression.
Parks says his starred thoughts stick with the students. He recalls a former drum major who's now a doctor.
He, you know, goes to accident sites and he massages hearts and that sort of thing. And he called me one summer and said, George, I want to come back and teach Drum Major Academy. I said, Scott, you're a doctor. You know, what are you thinking? He goes, I had 7 gunshots come in last weekend. And as I'm sitting there trying to figure out how to make everybody survive, all of a sudden I started hearing, starred thought, you're at your best when things are at their worst. Starred thought, you can never give up. And he said, George, I need more drum major starred thought so I can be a better doctor.
On the camp's final day, the percussion students, the color guard, the band, and the drum majors all file in and perform for their families and friends. The best squads from the daily contests compete for top honors, and then a final march-off teases out the single best marcher in the group. Parents are thrilled with the experience their kids have had. Reza Dre's daughter, Nicole, will be a high school senior and drum major in Warren, New Jersey this year. This is her second DMA, but her mom says it won't be her last.
Last year she went to the Drum Major Academy at Westchester, Pennsylvania, and she's actually going there again next week. The academy is fantastic.
When they're assembled and facing the audience, Parks congratulates the stiff rows of perfectly positioned students for enduring an intense week, and he implores them to pass on what they've learned.
Find that freshman and give them the best experience they've ever had. Detail the ready. And now, for the last time, you have to hear this from me. Detail attention! Detail parade! Good, make it great, and if we don't see you again, have a nice life. Drum majors, band, and color guard, order, park!
One, two!
And now, when I have you fall out, just once, perhaps, could we see more enthusiasm? Detail! Follow!
Pandemonium ensues as the kids relax and celebrate. Parents scoop in for photos. Tyler Salmon, a woodwind player from East Hampton, Connecticut, led the squad that won the final competition.
I was confident while I was doing it, but if you saw when I presented my arms, my hand was shaking every time that I did it.
He says this is the only day his group made it past the semifinals. Beyond the glory, though, he says he's taking home this lesson. Remember that the band is good, even if you don't always think so. For Only a Game, I'm Amy Mayer in Amherst, Massachusetts.
You're listening to Only a Game. We've told you now of how the bands will bleat and toot throughout the lands that starting now will be devoted to the thoroughly promoted games between the schools that may be number one, Calais. We've also mentioned several teams that striving to fulfill the dreams of coaches, boosters, students, too, will do what striving teams must do to rise above the slogging rest and claim distinction as the best. They'll eat together every meal to bond, and so that they can feel devotion to the chosen task, they'll live together, and they'll bask in adulation from the press. Though some will find their lives a mess on each occasion they approach a challenge where a football coach can't take them by the hand and say, "My friend, here's what you'll lift today." Or here are plays, so learn them well, for if you don't, hey, who can tell how long your scholarship will last when present may for you turn past? These players have been taught each day that they have come to school to play, though play's a label that's berserk, for what they're doing's no doubt work. They lift, they meet, they practice too. They study plays on blackboards you and I might be confounded by. That's if we saw them, you and I. But they do this in secrecy. Those plays are not for you and me. They're drawn by men whose golden touch ensures that they'll be paid as much as any 10 professors earn to help non-players daily learn. I'm not suggesting by that crack that every speedy running back and each enormous lineman there won't learn a thing or even care that where he's playing is a school. Although it's true that as a rule, the players choose where they will play according to the coach's sway, they're seldom moved by lesser forces, English, math, or history courses. Though a player still can study, it becomes a little muddy when that player's papers flow from someone paid to help him. So, impeded by some bookish shrew, he'll still do what he's there to do. So come bright fall, hooray for knowledge and for football played in college and for players who can load both on their plates and not explode. You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the extraordinarily well-funded practice of going fast and turning left. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. And hello to our new friends at WSDL in Ocean City, Maryland, KCPB in Warrenton, Oregon, and WXPR in Rhinelander. It's not one person, it's a town, Wisconsin, because in a general sense, there are lots of Rhinelanders in Wisconsin.
And I hope they're all listening.
And I hope none of them speak English.
The U.S. basketball team briefly encountered some competition when they played Mexico in the preliminary round of the FIBA Americas tournament. Otherwise, not so much in the way of competition, I gather.
No, and they've put together a terrific team, probably the best team they've had since the original Dream Team in 1992. One of the remarkable stats going into the quarterfinals was that Jason Kidd had taken five total shots in the tournament. And as my friend Bill Walton said on the broadcast, Jason's running a pure meritocracy out there.
In a tournament that has lacked the suspense provided by close games, at least as far as the U.S. team is concerned, U.S. coach Mike Krzyzewski has generated some sparks or some old flames or something like that.
Yeah, he's bonding back up with Kobe Bryant, who he had a probably 1% chance of recruiting to Duke when Kobe Bryant was coming out of high school and running into the NBA. He's been his primary defender. Kobe has, in fairness, played very, very well, especially on the defensive end.
And Coach Krzyzewski has also spoken recently about being courted by the pros.
Yeah, he says he's not going to look back. He's done, as he says, I've been married for 38 years and I don't write to my old girlfriends. That's a very good analogy as to why you stay alive. What it has to do with, you know, not coaching in the pros, I have no idea.
O.J. Mayo, the celebrated basketball player who is about to begin his freshman year at USC, announced this week that he might spend more than 1 year in college. What would have to happen for that circumstance to transpire?
Well, I suspect an ankle injury of some sort that keeps him out for most of the year. He says he plans on staying more than 1 year unless his situation changes. Guess what? If he has a really good year, his situation is going to change.
In pro basketball, the Milwaukee Bucks have somehow convinced E. John Leon and those who stand in his shadow that Milwaukee is a more hospitable place than they previously thought. How'd they do that?
Well, it's only a matter of time before the charm of the place overwhelms anybody, even someone from China. I suspect there were pecuniary incentives involved here, too. But I think they just showed him, you know, sunset over the Menominee River, and that was all it took.
It's all it took for you, right?
That's right. Over the Pabst plan is what it took for me.
At the World Track and Field Championships in Japan, Tyson Gay moved into position to equal the achievements of Carl Lewis and Maurice Greene. What does he still have to accomplish to join that company?
Well, he has to help his three teammates win the 4x100 relay, and I suspect, absent a dropped stick, he probably will do that.
At those same championships, to nobody's surprise, a Kenyan won the 1,500 meters, except that this guy sort of isn't a Kenyan, right?
Yes, the global economy works to our advantage once again. Bernard Lagat is 32 years old. He became a United States citizen in 2004. He's the first U.S. runner ever to win a World 1,500-meter championship. And now he's got his eyes focused on the Olympics, where no American, Jim Ryan or no, has won an Olympic 1,500-meter championship since Mel Shepard did it in the extremely insane 1908 Olympics.
At just the right time of the baseball season, we've got some genuine pennant races, or at least some genuine division races developing. You want to make some picks regarding Cleveland and Detroit, or perhaps the Mets, the Phillies, and the Braves, if not the Cubs, the Brewers, and the Cardinals?
Yes, I'm going to make a fool of myself here. I think the Detroit Tigers are finished. I think Cleveland is going to win that division fairly handily. I think the Mets will hang on and beat the Phillies, in whom I do not believe. I think, alas for my boys in Milwaukee, the Cubbies, it may be the Cubbies' year. Please God, it's not another 85-win La Russa ball team that gets into the playoffs. And I've got to admit, if you can name three people on the Arizona Diamondbacks, you're smarter than I am.
You know, your picks are keeping alive my dream World Series.
Of the Cubs and the Red Sox?
No, the Cubs and the Indians.
Why is that?
I don't know, just because it's two very unlikely teams, and I like that idea. Ozzie Guillen is still the manager of the Chicago White Sox. Are you surprised?
Yes, well, I am, and I'll be even more surprised if he's the manager when spring training arrives next spring. Ozzie Guillen is a noisy, buffet-turning-over kind of manager. His team has very clearly quit on this season. I suspect it's quitting on him. Those kind of managers have a very limited shelf life. They had very successful early runs, and then they burn out, call it the Billy Martin factor. The White Sox have lost 15 out of 18 games at a stretch. I will be very surprised if Ozzie Guillen's there for spring training.
Charlie, last week you made fun of David Beckham for not playing, although he had been playing a good deal for the LA Galaxy and for England as well, but perhaps you had entered into Charlie the fortune teller mode, and I just didn't know it, given Mr. Beckham's current status.
He now has a sprained medial collateral ligament, which gives him a reason not to play, but a reason to cash the checks. I you know, this is one of those situations where I just really feel bad for MLS because Alexi Lalas and those guys, they can't win for losing at this point.
Herman Mitchell, a 17-year-old football player who had said that he would attend the University of Oklahoma this fall, was shot to death last week, Charlie. The NCAA has granted a waiver that will allow Oklahoma boosters to pay for his funeral. Does this perhaps indicate a sea change in NCAA policy for other types of remuneration?
No, because if you go down in the fine print, and with the NCAA, there's always fine print, the waiver has three conditions: that the university takes control of the fundraising, and any funds that's already been donated, that the university use the funds to cover the funeral and memorial service with no money going to the family, and that any excess funds be donated to a Houston area nonprofit to be chosen by the university. Explain to me why the excess money can't go to the family. Give the mother some money. She can go on a vacation and try to live with this thing. What the NCAA is saying with that rule is that the extra benefit rule applies if you're dead.
And finally, Charlie, you got an email via our website this week, and I would like you to share with our listeners this email just in case any of them are serious Dale Earnhardt Jr. fans who have a very serious problem.
Yeah, I got a letter from Nicole Wool, who's a lawyer from Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills, California. And Counsel Wool apparently represents what she says is the country's leading tattoo removal chain, Dr. Tatoff.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Tatoff's shops are offering a 25% discount for anyone who wants to have Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s former number 8, removed from wherever they had it put on their body. I think this is remarkable entrepreneurship on the part of Dr. Tatoff, and I thank Counselor Wolf for bringing it to my attention.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
These traditions sure love me. The tribes to the fans and the seas. It's a common prayer we all need. Passed down from father to son, little slice of America. These traditions sure run deep.
NASCAR, by some measures the second most popular sport in the United States, began as a regional diversion in which the stars had learned their trade, trying to outrun the revenuers in cars loaded with moonshine. In his new book, titled The 200-Mile-Per-Hour Billboard, The Inside Story of How Big Money Changed NASCAR, Mark Yost chronicles the growth of the sport. He joins me now from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Mark, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
You write that 30 years ago, quote, at a time when professional sports were becoming sanitized, polished, and corporate, NASCAR offered an alternative to the NBA, the NFL, and Major League Baseball. How so?
The NASCAR stars are different than, say, the NBA or the NFL stars. I think they're a little bit more well-grounded, and they're a little less polished, and I think people like that. They're a little less slick, a little less corporate. That's changing somewhat. But they're still sort of real, touchable people, and they interact with the fans of far more than any other sport. It's in the book I say that, and it's quite true, that NASCAR is still the only sport where you can go in the locker room a half an hour before the game and visit with a starting quarterback.
Is it fair to say regarding sponsorship in NASCAR that sponsorship by the tobacco companies, especially R.J. Reynolds, provided the sport with the greatest shot of adrenaline that it had ever received?
It certainly did. And it was 1971, and the tobacco companies were barred by the federal government from advertising. And they'd wanted to get into NASCAR, and they had these tens of millions of dollars they'd been spending on advertising. And at that time, you could own the whole series for $100,000. So it was a sort of the perfect marriage. It gave some legitimacy to NASCAR. The tobacco companies came in and cleaned up the sport a little bit in the early 70s. A stock car track was not what it is today. It wasn't a sort of family-friendly place. There was a lot of drinking, foul language, that sort of thing. If the fans didn't like something the driver did, they would pelt the track with beer bottles and whiskey bottles and anything else they could pick up and throw. And as strange as it may sound today in the era of Nicorette sponsorship, R.J. Reynolds very much cleaned up the sport of NASCAR and legitimized it for many people.
As you say in the book, these days, virtually all major corporations are sponsoring cars, drivers, or both. To what extent has the corporatization of NASCAR resulted in the loss of something that originally attracted fans to the sport?
Well, I say that it's less corporate and less slick than the NFL or the NBA, but today, it's not by much. It's the drivers are all well-spoken. In fact, they go to spokesperson school, if you will, and they learn how to mention the sponsors' names without making it sound forced. Corporate America has brought a bit of slick and polish to the sport, but it's still a little bit rawer, a little bit rougher than, say, the corporate suites at an NFL stadium.
Some of the promotions you describe seem to have been designed to position NASCAR with a particular demographic. Humpy Wheeler, whom you call the P.T. Barnum of NASCAR promoters, has been behind some of them. Tell us about his most spectacular promotion.
He is the P.T. Barnum of NASCAR, and Charlotte is known for having the most extravagant, most outlandish pre-race entertainment. And in 1991, when we were at war or had just concluded the war with Iraq, he literally restaged the Gulf War in the infield of the Charlotte Motor Speedway. Fort Bragg is about 80 miles to the east of the track. He had airborne Rangers parachute in. He had special forces fast rope out of helicopters. And then he had a cardboard or wooden facade of the USS New Jersey rise over turn three and fire an imaginary salvo at the forces of Saddam Hussein.
You write that the military has always had a strong connection to NASCAR. How did that connection begin?
Well, NASCAR came of age, so to speak, in the late 1940s. A lot of these young kids who were moonshine runners had been in the military, and through the years, a lot of folks went off and joined the military, came back to the rural South. They learned to be mechanics in the military, and they came back and were ultimately hired by the local race team. And there's been a number of car owners and sponsors, military-related, sort of that red-blooded, red, white, and blue, middle America demographic that was predominant in NASCAR for so long. Played well with this military theme.
In 2003, the U.S. Army became a full-time NASCAR sponsor. They spent $16 million with MB2 Motorsports. What did the Army get for that investment?
Well, they get the opportunity to set up at every racetrack. And the interesting thing to me was there's a lot of 20-year-old kids that are NASCAR fans, primary recruiting targets, but what the recruiters all told me was what NASCAR gets them is access to the parents, who are often the decision makers. So they use the NASCAR team to demonstrate teamwork, something that's very important in the military. They use it to demonstrate esprit de corps, and then they use it to access the parents, the ones who might say, no, Junior, you're not joining the Marine Corps.
Well, access to the decision makers notwithstanding, you write of the Navy's involvement in NASCAR that they brought a flight simulator to the track specifically, quote, to entice 17-year-olds. Has it worked?
It has. There are studies from all branches of the military that show that when they go into areas that historically have not been good recruiting zones and there happens to be a NASCAR track there, and they go and set up their little kiosk that talks about all the military specialties, and when they target those areas through their NASCAR sponsorship, they see a significant uptick in the neighborhood of 30% of military enlistments.
You write about how some of the NASCAR drivers have become entrepreneurs of their own images. People who follow a particular driver can get a bank card with his picture on it. Are NASCAR fans more passionate about their heroes than fans of other sports are about the athletes that they admire most?
I think they are, because especially when it comes to college athletics, but this is certainly true of professional athletics, people tend to be fans of a team. You know, people are fans of the Dallas Cowboys, even though Roger Staubach or Troy Aikman's not there anymore. With NASCAR, it's very much a cult of the personality. You know, there's been a lot of talk about Budweiser leaving Dale Earnhardt Jr., and I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal in which I said, you know, these sponsors come and go all the time, and drivers leave teams all the time. And it's that cult of Earnhardt Jr. that is going to continue to draw those fans, whether his sponsor is Budweiser or Pepsi or whomever.
You suggest that corporate sponsorship of NASCAR will continue to grow, but you also maintain that last year there was a drop in NASCAR's overall popularity. Are those two developments related?
Somewhat. NASCAR is a fairly young sport. It only got a national television contract less than a decade ago. And if you look at other more mature sports, baseball, the NFL, they've all had peaks and valleys. And I think NASCAR's probably at a plateau. They did see incredible double-digit growth from the late 90s through a couple years ago. And I think what you're just seeing is more realistic growth, single digits, 7%, 8%, 9%. But I think it's a little premature to say that NASCAR has peaked.
Mark Yost is the author of The 200 Mile Per Hour Billboard, The Inside Story of How Big Money Changed NASCAR, published by Motor Books. He joined me from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. Mark, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Walter Dixon and Peter Lydotis. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Yolanda Perdomo's Cuauhtemoc Blanco photo gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from author Mark Yost as he leaves the studio. I guess he must be looking for that big sponsorship deal. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. NASCAR Die Hard.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR.